Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with the Week in Review for Saturday, August 22nd. I'm sick of the healthcare debate because half the time it seems we're talking about anything but the real issues as the national conversation bounces from government takeovers to death panels to insuring our gardeners to the awful care being provided to New York Mets players, a parochial topic, but important nonetheless, given the incompetent medical staff the team employs. President Obama is about as unfocused on this issue as any president I can recall in my memory. Yet this is what he wants to build his legacy on. I mean, the other day he wrote, or rather his aides did, a totally amateurish op-ed in the New York Times that included the following, quote, "Reform will finally bring skyrocketing healthcare costs under control, which will mean real savings for families, businesses, and our government. We'll cut hundreds of billions of dollars in waste and inefficiency in federal health programs like Medicare and Medicaid and in unwarranted subsidies to insurance companies that do nothing to improve care and everything to improve their profits." Close quote. Mr. President, the campaign is over. You can get away with such drivel while speaking to a bunch of obese folks at the Iowa State Fair prior to the primary. I was there, I know. Where everyone is just shaking their heads in approval because the fried sludge on a stick has dulled the brain, but not now. Talk specifics for crying out loud with real-life numbers that the experts can then pick apart for accuracy, not this garbage. No wonder Obama's approval ratings are tumbling, particularly on this very issue. In an NBC Wall Street Journal survey from this week, for example, only 41% of the Obama plan Only 41% approve of the Obama plan, whatever it is, and 47% disapprove. The Washington Post ABC poll from Friday has 50% disapproving. Obama himself is also issuing statements like, quote, "Whether we have a public option or not is not the entirety of health reform," close quote, but he's allowed his dwindling legions to run with that very issue, a government option that he then appeared to be abandoning, even though, as I'll reiterate, later, reform should be about real-life specific items that must be fixed today. Editorial, Washington Post. Maybe the White House meant to signal that it was backing away from its commitment to a public option as part of new health insurance exchanges. Or maybe the hedging words of administration officials were overinterpreted on an otherwise sleepy Sunday morning in August. It doesn't much matter because either way the reality is that if the Obama administration wants to get health reform done, it's going to have to back away from the public option sooner or later, and it's getting awfully late. Close quote. It's about political nose counting, getting 60 votes in the Senate, as much as anything else these days, and the votes aren't there, period. David Ignatius, Washington Post. Talking to Dr. Dennis Cortese, CEO of the Mayo Clinic this week, I heard two themes that cut to the heart of the debate. First, he thinks Obama's made a mistake in moving toward the narrower goal of health insurance reform, when what the country truly needs is health system reform. Imposing a mandate for universal insurance will only make things worse if we don't change the process so that it becomes more efficient and less costly. The system we have is gradually bankrupting the country. Expanding that system without changing the internal dynamics is folly. Second, Cortese argues that reformers should stop obsessing over whether there's a public option in the plan. Yes, we need a yardstick for measuring cost and effectiveness, but we should start by fixing the public options we already have. Cortese counts six existing public options that should be laboratories for reform. Medicare, with its 45 million patients and a fee-for-service structure that all but guarantees bad medicine. Medicaid, with an additional 34 million beneficiaries. Military medicine, through which government doctors deliver state-of-the-art care, the Department of Veterans Affairs, which has improved performance at its hospitals by embracing new technology, the TRICARE insurance plan for military retirees, and the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program. David Ignatius continues, adding a new public option for insurance, as congressional reformers are demanding, would be useful. But it's not necessary now, and it is creating a poisonous debate that's underperforming the more important reforms, which are in the delivery system, not insurance. If liberals really want to show they are serious, they should begin with our existing single-payer behemoths, Medicare and Medicaid. Cortese argues that the White House should mandate that within 3 years, these programs will shift from the current fee-for-service approach to a system that pays for value, that is, for delivering low-cost, high-quality care. This pay-for-value approach would amount to a cultural revolution in American healthcare. It would take our bloated system and make it cheaper and better. Obama has been campaigning furiously in this crazy summer of bogus debates about death panels, but he's losing traction. Reformers aren't helping by drawing a false line in the sand over a public option when we already have one in Medicare that provides a laboratory for systemic change. I hope that Obama understands that his health plan is in mortal danger and that it's time to call for the doctor. That was David Ignatius. Back on July 11th of this year, I quoted from an op-ed in the New York Times by former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill. As the healthcare debate is intensified, O'Neill's comments are worth repeating, and they are. Healthcare reform seems to be on the way, whether we want it or not, so I have been asking questions about the various proposals. Here's a sampling. Which of the reform proposals will eliminate the millions of infections acquired to hospitals every year? Which of the proposals will eliminate the annual toll of 300 million medication errors? Which of the proposals will eliminate pneumonia caused by ventilators? Which of the proposals will eliminate falls that injure hospital patients? Which of the proposals will capture even a fraction of the roughly $1 trillion of annual waste that is associated with the kinds of process failures that these questions imply? So far, the answer to each question is none. O'Neill also notes that Obama likes audacious goals. Here is one. Ask medical providers to eliminate all hospital-acquired infections within 2 years. This is hardly pie in the sky. Doctors and administrators already know how to do it. It requires scrupulous adherence to simple but profoundly important practices like hand washing, proper preparation of surgical sites, and assiduous care and maintenance of central lines and urinary catheters. That was Paul O'Neill. Just through these steps, we'd save countless lives and tens of billions of dollars every year. This week, I learned a good friend who had prostate cancer surgery and was home recovering on Monday when I talked to him, was struggling for his life a few days later as a result of what appears to be an infection picked up in the hospital, forcing a second operation as a result of septic shock. Every single one of you has a similar story. I'll never forget seeing an obituary of a young business executive here in Summit, New Jersey, a fellow in his late 30s, and asking a doctor friend of mine who worked at the hospital where the man was being treated what had happened. "Don't ask," she said. Paul O'Neill is spot on. There are so many far more important things we need to do immediately on a healthcare front before we tackle the issues most heavily debated today. Leadership, though, requires going down the list one at a time, picking them off, and launching a national campaign on each to educate both us and healthcare professionals. So again, start with the Secretary's first item. Which of the reform proposals will eliminate the millions of infections acquired at hospitals every year? That's where the outrage should be. America, number one? Hardly. And as much as us Republicans want to see tort reform at the top of the list, you're not going to until we begin to rein in the mistakes. Just my opinion. Turning to Wall Street, a lot of us wouldn't be surprised to see a decent-sized correction in the markets at any moment, but after a dip of less than 1% 2 weeks ago, the rally resumed, and from a news standpoint, there was legitimate cause for the bulls to celebrate, even if some in the bull camp may question valuation levels. First, the good news. On Friday, the National Association of Realtors reported that existing home sales soared in the month of July, far more than expected, to their best level since August 2007. While the median home price of $178,400 was less than June's, it was greater than May's $174,700, which I selfishly note, as I said last year, we'd bottom using this metric in the April-May timeframe. But when it comes to housing, you have the flip side, that not only are 30% or so of the sales foreclosed properties, a figure that is stabilizing, but as the Mortgage Bankers Association noted in its latest survey, 13.2% of mortgages on homes are in foreclosure or behind on the payments for the April-June period, up from 9% a year earlier. But now it's prime loans that are accounting for the lion's share of foreclosures and delinquencies as opposed to subprime, and that in turn hardly bodes well for consumer spending. So you have this constant battle between the good and bad, but when you add it all up, I would still offer that today it's two steps forward and one step back for housing. But I'd also reiterate a prediction of mine from long ago that when we do bottom, which is now, we just sit there for a while when it comes to median home prices. I know I've said this 30 times before, but I have to repeat. There will be no V-shaped recovery in housing. The progress we've seen is nonetheless welcome. I also consistently said that while there is this hue and cry over commercial real estate and its problems, this item would have no negative impact on equity prices, and I've proven right here as well. Yes, small and mid-sized banks will suffer, but when it comes to market sentiment, you and I don't stand around at cocktail parties talking about the value of the mall up the road. But we sure as hell talk about the home values in our neighborhood where the wealth effect plays with our psyches as well as consumer and market confidence. Period. Plus, there are actually some developing signs that commercial real estate is beginning to stabilize, at least in terms of office rents that appear to be in the bottoming phase. Meanwhile, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke told a crowd of economists on Friday that the global economy is, quote, beginning to emerge from recession, that prospects for growth appear to be good. Looking at the world economic outlook, far too much ink was spilled over China's leading Shanghai market and a 20% correction after a 65% rally. China will do just fine, but from time to time it gets stretched a bit. More importantly, the government expects positive growth in exports by year end. I don't know if I believe it, but should this turn out to be the case, that is a hugely positive development on all manner of levels, including it would mean the American consumers bouncing back. So watch this data as much as any other indicator worldwide, the balance of 09. Or let me watch it for you, the level of Chinese exports having a probable impact on my own China stock play. Elsewhere in Asia, Japan's GDP rose 0.9% in the second quarter, officially ending its recession, though the number was less than expected and provided some angst in our markets earlier in the week. While there are some now saying that India will actually grow at a faster pace than China in 2010. In Europe, the news was mostly positive as well. Eurozone manufacturing in August, as measured by the PMI data, jumped to 49.5 in August from the 45.7 level in July. So with 50 being the dividing line between growth and contraction, Europe is almost there. In France, the PMI reading was 50.2, in Germany, 49.0. But a word on inflation, or lack thereof. The July reading on producer prices in the U.S. was down 0.9%, or minus 6.8% the last 12 months, a six-decade low. In the European Union, the PPI has collapsed at an eerily similar 6.6% pace, an all-time low for it, while Asia faces similar declines. Yet there is still some warning us, as they have for seemingly a decade, that inflation is on the way, hide the wife and kids. Well, you haven't heard such talk from your editor. Wake me when wages start rising in a meaningful way and pricing power returns. We'll have plenty of time to act and buy gold, silver, cubic zirconium, whatever, when the evidence begins to point the other way. Today, concern yourself with deflation because that has a negative impact on earnings. And if it continues to be an issue, it's going to be tough rationalizing some of the earnings outlooks for 2010 that are seeping out, such as Goldman Sachs' call for $75 on the S&P 500. A reasonable market multiple of 15 on a S&P of 1150. Personally, I still refuse to discuss next year. Too much uncertainty on the geopolitical front as well as the potential for H1N1. Speaking of which, the World Health Organization said on Friday that there will soon be a period of further global spread of the H1N1 virus, and governments must step up preparations for a swift response. Many countries will see the number of cases double every 3 or 4 days for several months. Western Pacific Director Shin Young Soo said, at a certain point, there will seem to be an explosion in case numbers. We only have a short time period to reach the state of preparedness deemed necessary. Communities must be aware before a pandemic strikes as to what they can do to reduce the spread of the virus and how to obtain early treatment of severe cases. Of course, the developing world is going to get slammed as under-equipped and underfunded health systems crater under the strain. For my part, I continue to watch the media response. The test will be when the next wave really hits and whether or not the panic can be mitigated. Thanks to Friday's big advance on the housing data, as well as a surge in oil shares as crude hit its highest level since last October, on the feeling, at least for this week, that a pickup in the global economy will lead to increased demand for oil. The major equity averages all advanced about 2%, and the S&P 500, at its highest mark since October 08, is now up a stupendous 52% off the March 9 closing low. The Dow Jones, now at 95.05, is also at its highest level since last October. That's all for this week. I'll be back next Saturday, August 29th, for further details. Check my Week in Review column on stocksandnews.com. Have a great week.